We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Inside the Teen Brain. This ACAM series will leave you inspired by best practice and armed with tips to transform your work. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, and I have a special interest in the teenage brain. From puberty to about the age of 25, the brain is in a unique state, with core drives including identity, novelty, risk, peers, respect, autonomy, and intense emotions. In each episode, we explore one of these developmental drives and answer three big questions. What's the background? So what? And now what? So, to our first big question, what does the literature tell us? Adolescence is a time of heartfelt goals, according to Dahl, and indeed numerous imaging, self-report and observational studies illustrate it's a period of unique emotional sensitivity and intensity. It's perhaps perplexing that young people would evolve to be emotionally charged precisely when their world is in flux. Surely they'll feel overwhelmed. Well, it's certainly true for some. 75% of all mental health disorders emerge by the age of 25. But for most, it might be considered a perfect storm if we consider the utility of emotion. Among other functions, emotions are a crucible for learning. They grab attention and imprint experience with magnificent efficiency. Emotion ensures lessons learned in adolescence stick, particularly those learned by association. In convincing but not peer-reviewed cross-sectional data, Stevens Davovich showed that the odds are our favourite song is one released in the year we turn 13 or 14. The emotional brain confirms they really don't write them like they used to. Emotional regulation is the modulation of experience and expression. Positive regulation methods might include cognitive reappraisal, for example, and can be a protective factor against mental health conditions, but there are complications for the developing brain. Nuke described a dip in the ability to describe emotions in teens relative to younger children, and this is likely because teens begin to experience several emotions simultaneously, an effect that might be considered analogous to a proficient automatic car driver switching quite suddenly to using manual gears. Further data support an emotional regulation skill decline in early teens. Zimmerman, Blakemore, and other groups report distinct developmental, hormonal, gender, and emotion-specific patterns associated with various regulation approaches. As discussed in other episodes, the pull of the peer group is mighty. It's likely that peers invite such emotional reactivity in young people because they offer crucial learning experiences for future social inclusion. Groups at the University of Virginia and elsewhere offer robust evidence that social learning is top of the teenage brain agenda, with all its nuance and unpredictability. For example, Blakemore's data shows social reward is the ultimate reinforcer and peer exclusion the most aversive during teenage years. Individual differences in the experience of peer rejection may offer clues to understanding the development of mental health conditions. Part of this picture may be that mentalizing increases post-puberty, inviting adolescents to contemplate what others think of them. A developmental process that, of course, coincides with intense self-referencing emotions, such as shame. It's a heady mix indeed, but as Rilke said, no feeling is final. So let's get right to the heart of the matter. So now we turn to our second question and ask, so what? How do we apply these data? To guide us on this social and emotional tour of the teenager, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Eileen Kennedy Moore, author, psychologist, mum of four, based in Princeton, USA. Her numerous academic books and articles cover themes including emotion, mood, and coping strategies. She produces wonderful material for families, including the popular podcast about friendship and the Growing Friendships blog, which has over 5 million views. Her extensive range of book titles for parents includes The Unwritten Rules of Friendship, Simple Strategies to Help Your Child Make Friends. So it's a very warm and heartfelt welcome to our series, Eileen, and many thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jane. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's crack on because there's a lot to get through and a lot of content to discuss. So I'm going to dive in with my first question. And I want to think about emotional regulation. So as we know, adaptive emotional regulation is very likely a mental health protector. So can you describe some techniques that you've used in your practice to help teenagers manage their emotions?
Well, I think we want to start first with what are some themes that I commonly bring up with about emotions for teens in my practice. And usually when clients come in, it's because they feel bad and they want to stop feeling bad. But our job as psychologists is to expand their understanding of emotions, of themselves, of their relationships. So one theme that I often cover is that emotions are kind of like smells. So think about that. They can be pleasant or unpleasant, mild or intense, but they're not just things to be gotten rid of. They're a source of information about ourselves and our relationships and our environment. We want to use that information. And then I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. So another thing that I really focus on is that wrapping our feelings up in words is really important. Mm-hmm. And seeing the connections between the thoughts that trigger our feelings, their interpretation of what's going on, is very useful. That's one of the fastest ways you can regulate your emotions is think about the situation differently.
So and it really speaks well to the, you know, the cognitive behavioral framework really speaks well to the, you know, Matt Lieberman's affect labeling, doesn't it? The idea of contextualizing how we feel using words to make sense of our emotion and our, you know, consequent feeling. So I think that's beautiful.
Exactly.
I interrupted you, Eileen. Keep going.
No, please. But I mean, also, if you think about James Gross has written a lot about emotion regulation, and he talks about it as a whole series. And usually people focus on the end, punching pillows. Oh my gosh, there's no empirical evidence whatsoever that punching pillows does a lick of good. In fact, it tends to rehearse and intensify negative feelings when we're acting out on it. But if we start way earlier in the sequence with the environment or the thoughts, then it's easier. It's way easier than dealing with it after we're already aroused. So I'm a clinician, so I'm going to try to squeeze in as many practical ideas as we can do.
Yes,
so one
yes.
thing that I've used with kids as young as 4, all the way up to my teenagers, is what I call feeling cards. So I'll take some index cards and I cut them in half just because they're a nice size. And then I will work with the teen to name as many emotions as we can think of. And I, in my mind, I'm stacking the deck a little bit with, with the ones that I think that they need. But we do the whole range. We do positive ones. We do the angry family. We do the sad family. We do the anxious family. We do the self-conscious emotions. Mm-hmm. Like jealousy or pride or guilt or shame. And then I have the teen sort the cards to describe how they're feeling right now. And they sort them into 3 piles. Yes, no, maybe a little bit. So how are you feeling right now? And it turns it into a recognition task rather than something that they have to pull out of themselves. So they can decide, am I feeling discouraged right now? Yes, no, maybe a little bit. And then after they do that, I will have them go through the yes pile and say, so what is making you feel discouraged today? And then they can talk through this. This is also a really useful technique to share with parents because what do parents do? They usually leap in to fix things, but let's just slow it down and acknowledge the feelings. The other thing is it shows 2 important themes for teens. One is that we rarely have just one feeling at a time. Mm. Our feelings are almost always a constellation of a whole bunch of different things. And I'm using the word feelings generically to describe all emotional experience. And the other theme is that they change. So if you do the feeling cards now and you do it 2 hours or 2 days later, you'll probably get a different constellation And then if they don't have that many in the yes pile, I'll go through the maybe a little bit pile. That's good too.
But there's so much about that that's really is very affirming. It also, I'm noticing, of course, it includes a whole range of emotion, both the socially acceptable and the less socially acceptable. You know, for example, jealousy is written down there on a card, and that somehow gives a young person permission to recognize that that's a feeling that we all feel. So I think that's a wonderful exercise, and that it's a practical one is also somehow it allows the emotional intensity to be drained away. So I think it's a wonderful idea, and the idea that you can do this developmentally from young kids to teenagers means that emotional literacy can develop. You can do that over and over and over again, even as a family, as you say.
Right, and it makes it easy. Because how many times do you have a teenager sitting there and you'll ask them, how are you feeling about that? Oh, no. Or, so how are you? Oh, no. You know, those teenagers who are not going to talk to you, this makes it easy. It's a segue in. And then the talking about, so what is making you feel jealous? Then we can talk through it. So a third theme that I have in my work is the interpersonal context of emotion. So if we, and this is something that I think CBT has really neglected, but it's something that I find so interesting. My very first book was for mental health professionals. It was called Expressing Emotion, Myths, Realities, and Therapeutic Strategies. And it talks about how expression is the link between internal experience and the outside world. And it is deeply connected to who we are, how we feel, how we connect with others. So this is so important. Our teenagers tend to have binary thinking about emotions. Either I let it all out or I hold it all in. And of course, there are many, many options in between those. So If we think about the interpersonal context, where do our big emotions come up? Usually it's related to somebody else important in our lives. So we don't just have anger in the abstract. You know, I'm angry at her because of what she did yesterday, and that's so unfair. And how I express those feelings, how I communicate those feelings, is going to have a big impact on my relationships. So that can be really, really powerful.
Well, that really, I mean, that's wonderful. And I think you're right to highlight the CBT neglect somewhat of the contextual and the interpersonal issues. I think it's a really important one to highlight. I was going to ask about your academic writing on emotion, and you've raised it already. Because I wondered how much you described the theoretical aspects, and I, you know, specifically talked about expression versus experience. How much do you make that explicit with the young people you work with, or is it implicit in the work that you're doing?
Both. So sometimes I'll do what I call a feeling story. So I'll just draw a circle. I like to draw with the kids because I just think it sticks in their head better than all of our adult yammering. So I talk about what starts out is there's an event. And as soon as that event happens, we people are meaning-making creatures. So we start thinking about, well, what does this mean about our relationship? What does it mean for me? And those thoughts trigger feelings. And now we cross the line between the inner experience towards the outer observable part, the expression. And so our feelings are going to trigger or make more likely or make us want to do certain actions, but we have a choice about that. And then our actions are going to trigger reactions from the other person. Now, the beauty of which could be another event setting the whole cycle in motion and again, but the beauty of laying out this cycle is that every single one of those points is a point of intervention. So with the event, we might want to change the situation. With the thoughts, well, we got a lot we can work with there. For instance, research tells us that kids and adults who are prone to anger tend to assume that they did it out of deliberate meanness. Usually they didn't. So sometimes I'll talk with kids about what are some other reasons why they might have done it. Let's see how many we can come up with. And maybe they did, maybe they were annoyed, or maybe they didn't get enough sleep last night. Maybe they were annoyed with their mom. And they just happened to say something to you. Maybe they didn't realize. When we come up with lots of maybes, it makes the deliberate meanness explanation seem less likely.
And that reappraisal is such a positive emotional regulation skill.
Exactly. And it's way the heck upstream, which is great. Yes. Yeah.
So it's about getting it in, and I like the way, and I would agree. We've actually had a couple of other episodes thinking about the power of drawing and visual expression as well. And
Yes.
so that's a very powerful description, because you can see, as you say, what's upstream and where your intervention and your emotional regulation is more likely to be effective, way upstream, as you say. And it shows that cascade of context effects, and when things are burning brightly, it's harder to bring in some of your coping strategies. So I think that's a wonderful piece of
Yeah, and
information.
keep working around with the once the emotions start coming up, we can harness our capacity to feel more than one thing at the same time. So you're nervous about this? Are you a little bit excited too? Can you pay attention to those feelings? You're mad at her? Can you find a little bit of compassion too? And it's not that the one erases the other, but it softens it. So that can be very useful too. And of course, in terms of behavior, we've got a lot of control over that. We can make a lot of choices about how we communicate with other people, and we can anticipate how they're going to do that. So many options rather than just hold it in or blast them.
So you're really unpacking it and unfurling. It's as if you are, lifting the hood of a car, or unpacking a recipe, putting things into steps so you can see how the outcome might be. We might roll back the film and look at what happened at the beginning of that scene. That's great. It's a really and I can feel your creativity in the way that you're describing it, because that is half the battle, isn't it? About getting the young
Exactly.
person engaged in the idea that there is a way to look at this differently, or to, manage your emotion, or manage your behavior, or manage the context in a different way. So I think that's wonderful.
And it really is about the engagement, because you can have the most beautiful techniques, but if you don't have a connection with that kid, you're not going to get anywhere. So that is really an important part. And sometimes we can use that connection. So I had a client once, a teenage girl, and she was ripping herself apart about my this is too big and my that is too small. And I'm listening and I'm listening. And then I knew her pretty well, so I could use the relationship. And I said to her, "Do you think I should quit my job, stop seeing clients, stop writing books and articles and podcasts and so forth, and just spend 8 hours a day working on my abs? I'm sure they would look a lot better than they do now if I devoted a full day, all of my time to working on my abs. What do you think?" And fortunately, she laughed. And I said, "How do you know that I'm not going to do that?" And the answer is because it's not my values. I try to exercise, I try to be healthy, but I'm not going to devote my life to my abs because I just don't care that much. So the context of the harnessing teenagers' values, this is such a wonderful stage because they're beginning to be able to think at a more abstract level and being able to pull in your values. Who do you want to be? So I'll tell you another strategy that I use pretty often. Psychologists sometimes talk about egosyntonic moments. And this is a terrible name, and I haven't come up with a better one. But when you describe it to kids, it's those moments when we say, "This is who I am or who I want to be." And I tell kids, pay attention to when those happen. Write them in your phone. Keep a little running notes about that, because those are breadcrumbs sort of guiding you to the direction that you want to go.
But you say so, you know, you use such evocative cases to show this. And actually, we had another episode where we talked to a young person who described her experience in child and adolescent mental health services. And the thing that mattered most to her and to her peers was that the clinician cared about what she was up to, what mattered to her. And that was the leverage on which the rest of the technical stuff could happen. There is nothing without the foundation of the relationship.
Absolutely.
And so I think this is really, you know, I think it's a terribly important point. No matter what our clinical issue, no matter what technique we're using, we will get nowhere unless we've got a connection. And allowing the young people to say, you know, whoever I am, whatever that moment is, that breadcrumb is worth something to me. I'm listening to that and I'm interested in that, I think is very powerful. Yeah, that's wonderful stuff. That's great. Yeah. I wanted to move, and you've really touched on it a little bit. You know, we know that emotions and the social world are very tightly entwined in the teenage years. And we know that the experiences with peers contribute to the success of future relationships and mental health status, both now and in the future. So if we had a situation, clinically speaking, where there's a teenager who's being persistently excluded by their peer group, how would you support them? What techniques have you found successful?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I believe this so deeply. When we think about the epidemic of loneliness among adults, and the mental health crisis among teens and the general divisiveness in our world, it has never been more important to teach young people to build strong and caring relationships. Like, this is urgent. So I've done most of my work about friendship has been, or my writings about friendships has been with younger kids. But the number one reaction that I get from parents to this is, this applies to adults. It's like, yes, you know, it's not like we learn it at age 9 and then we're done. You know? Even as adults in new situations and new relationships, we're continuing to learn about getting along with other people. So one thing that's really important to understand is that social skills are not about doing one thing. They're about being able to flexibly adjust our behavior to fit the situation, to fit us, to fit the relationship. And we don't all have to become a bounding into the room, life of the party extrovert. There is definitely room in the world for a quieter way of interacting. Broadly speaking, when we're thinking about any problem, but especially a social skills issue, we want to think, we have three options. We can change the environment, we can change the person, or we can change the match between the environment and the person. The last one is usually the easiest. So when a kid is feeling rejected at school, for example, I would be thinking hard with that teenager about what is it that they like to do that they could do with other kids. And that could be the basis of a genuine connection. Kids make friends by doing things, doing fun things together. So what can we do to help this kid find their people? And sometimes I need to pull the parents in to prod a little bit, because it's uncomfortable. It's scary, especially when you've faced rejection before. And I will full on acknowledge that this is raw courage. What you're doing right now by showing up for the robotics club, that's the same as me jumping out of an airplane with a parachute. You know, this is really, really scary. And I know you can do it. Now, so in terms of changing the person, we might be able to teach particular skills. So in one of my books, I talk about 5 essential social skills. So reaching out to make friends, stepping back to keep friends, blending in to join friends, speaking up to share with friends, and letting go to accept friends. We need all of those. And if you're thinking about clients now, you can probably go, that one, that one, that one, you know, and they're different. You know, some kids, for example, need to recognize stop signals. So I'll make a list with them. Okay, how do you know somebody wants you to stop? Quit it. Cut it out. You're being annoying, or sometimes it's nonverbal. When you hear one of those or see one of those, you need to stop, because otherwise you're signaling to the other person, I don't care how you feel. Now, stopping is hard for some people, so we have to give them particular strategies to stop. Sometimes it's physical, like sit on your hands, or you know, pretend your tongue is stuck to the roof of your mouth. Another thing to do is to say a statement like, okay, I'll stop now. Like, it's a little bit unusual, but at least you're signaling to the other person, I heard you, I'm working on it. And it gives them that extra 2 to 3 seconds to kind of rein things in. But this is part of our big cycle of noticing how the other people are reacting, as opposed to just what I'm feeling. This is so important, and it's so hard. Theory of mind starts around age 4, and we are more empathic at 29 than we were at 19, and probably at 39 than we were at 29. So it's something that we have to constantly be working on, and we can do that. But with other kids, we might be helping them to make their way into a situation. And here a good formula is match the emotional tone of the group, or you can say watch then blend. So you're not sure what you to do, watch what the other kids are doing, and then slide into the action without interrupting. And when with teens, it's usually a conversation. So listen first, hear what everybody's saying, pick up on what is the emotional tone. So if everybody is complaining about the history test, and our kid comes in and says, well, I thought it was easy. Ooh, you know, that's like the melody's going on, la, 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 la. And, you know, there's a sour note. So we don't want to do that. Now, she doesn't have to lie and say and pretend she's stupid. That, you know, deceit isn't a path towards closeness. But she could say, yeah, I can't believe there were 4 short answers. Or, yeah, I can't believe we had to do that in the same week that we had to do the math test or something like that.
So it's the fine art of blending into the peer group, which of course is absolutely fundamental to the teenager and their brain, and staying authentic, staying true to who you are.
Exactly.
And that, you know, and I think that the importance of these social experiences is that they are so nuanced and they are so unpredictable. And, you know, if it were a maths equation, you know, the social learning experience probably would be a few months, not 15 years. Right. So I think that's really, you know, because it's an evolving and iterative experience in terms of how we develop these social skills. I love the way that you have these practical ideas that a teenager could use to try out, come back and maybe, you know, review how did it go, what went well, what was easy about that, what was difficult.
Exactly.
Because you know, often although teenagers are thinking more abstractly, they need some concrete skills too and some concrete action to take to start the integration into peer groups. It's beautifully described. I wonder if you could, because one of the things that I really struck by as you were talking is the idea of the experience or the perception of our peer group. And there's some interesting emerging data showing that our perception of peer rejection, particularly as a teenager, might offer some clues to mental health difficulties. And I know you've spoken in the past about the difference between meanness and bullying. Could you say a little bit about that and how we might support a teenager to understand the difference between the two, because that perception might make a difference to how they experience their social world.
Exactly. And this is fundamental with social anxiety. So researchers have a very specific definition of bullying. It involves deliberate meanness, targeting a specific person, usually repeatedly over time, although sometimes one especially horrible action can count. But the most important part is that there is a power difference between the kid doing the bullying and the kid being targeted. This power difference is what makes it difficult or impossible for the kid being targeted to handle it on their own. So it's either the kid doing the bullying is bigger, stronger, more socially powerful, or it's a group of kids picking on one kid. And then that's bullying. If there is no power difference, it's not bullying. It's just a conflict. So that is something that kids need to be able to learn how to handle with support and guidance, of course, with people from adults who care about them.
Or even perceive, because I think there's a difference in the perception of that and say, well, that kid's mean, maybe I don't get along with them, to as compared to I've been bullied, because that's...
Exactly. The bullying, if we really want to be careful about overusing the B word, because it's saying to kids, you're a victim. You are fragile. You can't handle it if anyone is even slightly mean to you. And that is not something that... a message that is empowering for kids. Mm-hmm. It's a dead end. But basically we're saying there's no hope here. So, mm-hmm. or, you know, the adults have to fix it. Sometimes that's true. And absolutely, we need to step in those cases of true bullying. But on the other cases, we need to guide the kid. I had a middle schooler come in once and tell me, I was bullied today. And I said, oh, what happened? And he said, this kid, he told me, quit making that annoying noise. No, that is not bullying. Yeah. I had another girl who was on the bus with a friend, and the friend started sitting with somebody else, and she was deeply hurt. So she decided to write her friend a letter listing all the mean things the friend had ever done. It was a take her down kind of letter, because she felt that the friend was bullying her. And then the friend promptly accused her of bullying her with this long letter. And no, this was not bullying on either side. This was just a clumsy effort to deal with a friendship rough spot. And it was poignant on both sides. And it was something that we could deal with. You know, there were many paths forward other than, you know, labeling either one of them as a bully.
Well, and I know you do lots of work with middle schoolers, and there's, you know, a huge amount of resources that the ACAM audience can go and look at and I'm sure learn from. And although our focus is on the teenage years here, we know that, of course, prevention is better than cure. So if you're thinking about the middle schoolers, so those kids in middle school, we'd call them, you know, late primary school in the UK, what do you recommend? And we've touched on some of them, but maybe you could add a little to that. What would you recommend to young people and their families in terms of preparation for adolescence? So they're fostering good mental health when things are more vulnerable. They're fostering positive peer relationships when peers matter so much. What's your prevention strategy?
So we really want to make space and make time for their friendships. If you think about it, the teen years are about stepping out and discovering who they are outside the immediate family. And what's interesting is the research shows that the importance of parents does not decrease as kids move into adolescence, but the importance of peers skyrockets. And if you imagine it, there's an antelope alone on the savannah. That is bad. That is very dangerous. So of course, as they're moving away from the family of origin, they want to be in the herd. And that's okay. That's developmentally appropriate. So, because sometimes I hear parents saying, "Well, I want my kid to be a leader." Well, you know, let them join first, and they'll find their way. It's really the middle school years that the kids are focused on being exactly the same as everybody else. And once they get into high school, it's more they understand that they can have different groups, and they can have their friends can have more than one friend, and it expands a little bit. The young adolescents spend a lot of time pondering, am I really lazy or am I really hardworking? And by the time they get to 17, they know I'm both. You know, we all are. So. We want to respect that they are the developmental progression of things. Parents often tell kids, you shouldn't care what other people think. Well, that's not possible. It's just not. They need to care what other people think. And we all do, right? But we can help them think about whose opinion matters to you. And let's try to think that. So one of the main things that I think gets in the way of kids making friends is what I call the magnet myth of friendship. So this is the belief that I have to be so amazing and wonderful that I draw friends to me the way a magnet attracts metal. This is a myth. It does not work with that, like that. Your peers do not want to be the metal. And if you're looking for that, wow, she's amazing reaction, you are not looking for friends. You are looking for fans. And sorry.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, very nice.
So the magnet myth can keep kids holding back. It's like, oh, I'm not amazing. I can't possibly reach out. Doesn't matter. Or they can reach out in not so good ways by bragging or showing off and trying to impress everybody, which does not work. So friendship is fundamentally a relationship between equals. If we think of two overlapping circles, and yes, I draw those all the time, this is you, this is the other kid, that overlap in the middle, that is the common ground. That is where friendships begin. So if you're talking about something that's true only of you, that's irrelevant to building the friendship. So what do you have in common? Especially, what do you like to do with other kids? And let's find a way to do that. Another thing is, the single best way that kids can deepen their friendships is with those one-on-one get-togethers. So, but a lot of times they hold back. And they're like, well, I don't know them that well. It's like, that's backwards. You know, if you've had fun with them once, good enough, invite them over. Even if they say no, it's a compliment, because you're saying, hey, I like you enough to spend time with you outside of where we have to spend time together. So get them over.
And I think that's a really interesting point about the idea of these one-to-one friendships. So that's where the nuance and the sort of fine tuning happens. And we know that obviously in middle childhood, kids tolerate adults being around more, and they are more likely to follow their lead explicitly, though, as you say, in teenage years, you know, parents continue to have really important roles to play. So there's an opportunity there. There's a window of opportunity to teach and perhaps get slightly a developmentally appropriate way involved in terms of modeling good behavior, you know, perhaps being around at a play date or whatever. You know, so parents have a little chance before kids get into the more independent social world, where things, you know, they just have to, you know, fly solo without a parent. But they've been, you know, all the good stuff that parents have taught them are baked in through those middle school years.
Yeah,
so really, there I mean, is it's a, really nice.
Yeah, there is a special opportunity there, but we can still do it in the teen years, because parents control access and opportunity. And you can also say, you know, give them a choice. You have to do an activity. You can do this one or this one. You pick. So, of course, with teenagers, we always want to give them, even with younger kids, we want to give them choices so they have a sense of autonomy. We can also ask good questions to help teens think things through. So, for instance, and this is harnessing their new ability to think beyond the present moment, right? So two questions that I often ask kids are, what is the reaction that you're hoping for from that other person? And what kind of communication is most likely to get that reaction? And they usually have not thought about that. You know, it's just, I'm mad, therefore, you know, or I'm shy, therefore. And, you know, that's the end of the conversation. But we can guide them in really thinking this through. And then they are imagining the other person's perspective, not as a, do they like me, but as a, what are they like as a human being?
Mm-hmm. Apologies for interrupting, Eileen, please. You describe so beautifully the, you know, a consultative model. Just ask the question and the teenager is likely to give you the answer that you would love to lecture, as it were.
Exactly.
But you've turned it around. So the teenager is answering their own question, developing their own, reflection, which is far more powerful. So it's a very, that's a very effective strategy. Eileen, we could talk all day, but I think we should turn to our final question, which is a now what. So perhaps with clinicians in mind, can you offer one practical tip which would improve the service we offer our young people? Perhaps something that could be slipped into current practice without too much cost or organization.
Okay, so I'm going to do two.
Okay, go for it.
Because I'm cheating.
I think you've got so much to tell us.
Yeah, one for parents and one for kids.
Yeah.
So for parents, As clinicians, it is incredibly helpful if we can teach them to empathize with their kids. So I give them specific scripts of, so the basic one is, you're feeling blank because blank. Or another one is, it's hard for you when, it bothers you when, you wish. And I say to the, and you know, if you've got a prickly teen, you can add, it sounds like, or it seems like, but usually just saying it. And then I have them written out, and then I say, circle the word you in all of these. Notice that there's no word I. It's all about you. And this is a dippy intervention, but some of us have made a career out of it, because wrapping those feelings up in words is so powerful. And so I had a mom once who, the teenager came home spitting nails about something that the teacher had done. I don't remember what. And the mom told me afterwards, it's like, for once I remembered that thing about the reflection. And so she said, you're feeling mad because the teacher did whatever. And the kid said, yeah. And she always does this thing. It's hard for you when she always does this thing. And she goes, yeah. And it's so not fair. It really bothers you when she does that. And the kid says, yeah. And she should be doing the other thing. And the mom said, you wish she would whatever. And the kid said, yeah. And you see the softening. So I tell the parents, wait for problem solving until you see the softening in their face or in their body. And they're not going to say, why, yes, mother, what an insightful observation. But you will see that softening. You'll get that grunt of acknowledgement. And then and only then you ask, so what do you think you might do? And the girl said, I guess I'll go talk to the teacher. And she stormed off. And the mom was like, huh, it worked. So reflecting their feelings, asking rather than telling, is really powerful. The second tip for kids, and this is not, oh gosh, I've got two things I want to tell you about kids. Okay, so I'm going to talk fast. So the first thing is for peers. And this is something I call the soft criticism. It is probably the best thing I've ever invented, because it works. And it works for teens, and it works for us as adults with spouses or coworkers or whoever. So the normal response to criticism is to defend. Well, it's not my fault, and you do it too, and they do it worse. This is human nature. So the soft criticism is designed to get around that normal defensiveness. And the step one is we give an excuse. The excuse says that we know they're a good person with good intentions, even when they mess up. So instead of barraging a friend who did something wrong, because they're going to do something wrong, we can start with the soft criticism. We give an excuse. I know you didn't mean to. You probably didn't realize. I get that you were trying to, whatever. And this is good for parents with kids as well. So the excuse puts us on the same side rather than against them. And practically, if we give an excuse, they don't have to come up with one, and we can just skip that part. So the second step is we describe the problem. And here our formula is, when you, bad behavior, bad outcome. So when you tell people things that I told you in confidence, it really upsets me. I want to be in charge of who knows what. And then the third step is probably the most important, which is about focusing on moving forward, because whatever happened, happened. You know, we can't undo that. We can only move forward. So with a parent, they might ask the kid, what can we do to prevent this? Or what could you do instead? Or with a kid to appear, you might ask, from now on, could you please? And we'll move forward in that way. And this is much better than blasting somebody. Okay, so, and then the last thing that I want to tell you is a formula that I use with kids, with parents, and I call it the angry adult formula. So usually when adults are mad, they, you know, do the whole thing about, you always do this and you never do that. And if you keep on like this, you're going to end up like that. So I tell kids, you have the power to calm down an angry adult, but only if you use the formula exactly as I teach it to you. So when the adult does their whole big thing, your job is to find a kernel of truth that you can agree with. And then you say the words, you're right. You're not agreeing with everything, just that tiny kernel of truth. So step one is you're right. Step two is you have to show them that you get their point, right? So you say, I should have blank. And step three, because you want to pull it into action, right? Words are only so good. Then you say, I'll do it now. Or if you really can't do it now, you say, from now on. So you're right, I should have, I'll do it now. And I'll drill them on that. Say it again three times, close your eyes. You're right, I should have, I'll do it now. And I tell them, I had a teenager who this saved her job. So what happened was the kid, the boss would call her and say, I need you there 4 o'clock on Thursday or whatever. Until one week, he didn't call her until he called her yelling at her and said, you're supposed to be here. And, you know, I can't have employees who don't take this responsibility seriously. And if you don't want this job, et cetera. Now, the kid could have said, well, you didn't call me, but that would not have gone well. So instead, she remembered the formula and she said, you're right. I should have checked the online schedule. I'll do that from now on. Would you like me to come in now? Boom. And I'll drill kids on this. So I'll say, okay, I'm your mom. You be you. Here's the formula. You ready? Okay. Honestly, Pete, how many times do I have to tell you, don't leave your shoes in the middle of the walkway. I'm not your maid, you know, and anybody could trip on this. And the kids are like, oh, my mom said that.
It's time for the formula.
Right. You're right. I should have put my shoes in the basket. I'll go do it now. Boom. It's
beautiful.
Done. It's done.
I think
and
that's
it's not giving in. It's communicating effectively and resolving a conflict. Look at you go.
And watching, I'm sure, the success, which is so reinforcing to a young person, you know, particularly when they're managing something as difficult as your first boss or similar. I think that's brilliant. I suspect if we had more time, Eileen, we could get more and more fantastic stuff. But unfortunately, we've had to come to the end of this episode. So all that's left on my agenda is to thank you, Dr. Kennedy Moore, for sharing some of your absolutely superb experience with the ACAM audience.
My pleasure.